Morning, everyone. Welcome to the MPCA's April 22nd, Earth Day, 2014 Citizen Board meeting. And I'd like to call this meeting to order. And if I could, ask board members to quickly review the agenda and if you're so inclined, a motion to approve, please. Motion by Mr. Riddle. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Dr. Sampson. Any discussion? Seeing none. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. The agenda is adopted. Let's move on to the approval of the minutes from the last meeting, which was February 25th, 2014. And board members, if you have any comments on the agenda, I'll note those. Any corrections? The minutes, excuse me. Any additions or corrections to the minutes? Otherwise, I'd look for a motion to approve.
Motion to approve as distributed.
Mr. Ibarra moves to approve the minutes as distributed. Is there a second?
I second.
Second by Dr. Drager. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The minutes of the February 25th meeting are approved. Let's move on to our legal report. Leah Hedman is here this morning for Karen Olson. And Leah, I'll have you introduce yourself and also just give the report.
Good morning. My name is Leah Hedman, as he's indicated. I'm an assistant attorney general. I work in the State Natural Resources Division of the Attorney General's Office. I'm here substituting on behalf of Deputy Attorney General Karen Olson today. I don't have any items for the legal report other than the item I think you're going to bring up in your report.
I will.
That you'll talk about. But otherwise, I don't have any additional items, and I think we have a very full agenda. So maybe
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Hedman. Let's move on to the commissioner's report. I have five things. The first is the North Dakota lawsuit status, which challenged provisions of the Minnesota Renewable Energy Standards Act. And I just wanted to read the statement that Governor Dayton released on Saturday, I believe it was on Saturday or Friday, excuse me. And the court, the federal court, decided to strike down part of Minnesota's Next Generation Energy Act, and here's what the governor had to say. I strongly disagree with the federal court's decision to strike down an essential part of Minnesota's Next Generation Energy Act. My administration will appeal this decision and oppose North Dakota's intentions with every means at our disposal. I will defend the state of Minnesota's right to protect the quality of our air that citizens breathe. The state statute does not prevent anyone from building and operating a new power generating facility whose toxic emissions will affect Minnesota's air quality. It only requires that those new emissions must be offset by the same or greater reduction in emissions from other plants. In other words, Minnesota's law encourages the replacement of older, more polluting power plants with more efficient, cleaner facilities. In this case, North Dakota operators propose to build new coal-fired power generating plants without offsetting emission reductions. Prevailing winds will carry those toxic emissions directly into Minnesota. That shameful practice should not be permitted by either the state or federal government. End of governor's statement. So just I'll forward to board members the findings of the court when they're available. As well as a copy of that statement from the governor, but we will, our staff, Assistant Commissioner David Thornton was deposed in the process of that lawsuit, as were many other officials from state and federal agencies and other groups. So we'll keep you posted on the status of that lawsuit. But you clearly hear where the governor that the governor wants to argue further on the case, it would appear. Second item on my list is we recently sent to the EPA our 303D under the Clean Water Act 2014 impaired waters list. which is a huge undertaking for our staff to organize and prepare based on months and months of data review and collection. And I just wanted to read a quick message from Katrina Kessler, one of the managers in our water assessment and environmental information section. She said, this is a significant milestone that should be recognized. Completion of 2 years worth of monitoring data, desktop review, watershed assessment team reviews, professional judgment meetings, public notices, public meetings, and response to comments is a significant accomplishment of our staff. So just wanted to let everyone know that list is put out now, and that will make its way to EPA. EPA then will respond to us in due course. But our staff does this on a regular basis, and it's kind of the substance of our water quality work across the state is looking at our impaired waters list. This is what'll get when it finally gets completed and reviewed. You'll see new waters listed, new sections of rivers, new impairments listed for Minnesota, but you'll also see some that will be removed from the impairment list, hopefully by the good and concerted efforts to improve land and water across Minnesota. So that's on its way. We'll forward a copy of that to you as well. Third, I attended the Environmental Council of States spring meeting in Sausalito, California, earlier this month. ECOS is the acronym for the Environmental Council of States. It is the group of my peers from across the nation. And so I go to those meetings. This one was particularly well attended for the first time that I can recall. Every member state had a representative there but one. And so that was pretty impressive. The EPA had every one of their regional administrators in attendance and every one of their office and administrative staff administrator appointees at the meeting as well. So it was pretty significant attendance by EPA, which is not always the case. We spent a fair amount of the meeting talking about 111D, the new source regulation for carbon emissions from power plants and new power plant facilities. We also did pass a number of resolutions, which once they're finally published and out from ECOS, I'll send you a copy of those so you can see what ECOS resolutions look like. They basically implore EPA and the federal government agencies to do things that the states feel would be beneficial for air, land, and water quality. There are some things that cross over because some states have their drinking water programs within their environmental agencies, so some of them kind of sound health department-like, which is part of the responsibilities of ECOS is to look across the Safe Drinking Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, RCRA, and all the other toxics and so forth. So I'll forward those resolutions on to you as well. My fourth item, I'm going to hand off to Deputy Commissioner Michelle Beeman to talk about a letter that we all received and sort of put that in context for board members.
Thank you. Good morning. What I wanted to refer to is I believe all board members in the mail got a pleading, actually, to the Office of Administrative Hearing. It's titled VONCO SSO Operations Post-Hearing Comments and Request for Preservation of the Video Record. And you're probably wondering what this is. I'm not sure why you received it. This is out of sequence from anything that the board has in front of it. As you'll hear today, we have feedlot rules on our agenda today. We have a number of rulemakings processes underway. This is part of what is a compost facility rulemaking effort that we're in the middle of. There is the public comment period for the proposed rule just closed yesterday. What you received was one of over 100 different comments that came in from one party. This is VONCO, a waste management company. Out of, like I say, we have hundreds. The agency is responding to those. The ALJ now has that full record, including our response to this and the other comments. The ALJ has 30 days to issue a report. That will happen by the end of May. We then need to work with that. We anticipate bringing the rule, much like the feedlot rule today, to the board later summer. We don't know exactly which month. So I would just encourage you to set this aside. Wait till you have the full package. Frankly, this is very inflammatory. I think things are taken out of context. And without seeing the other comments as well as the agency's response, I don't think it's useful for you at this point. So I've just set that aside until we have it on the agenda and you can see the packet, and as well as the ALJ's report, which will be part of that, who's also analyzing this. So.
Thank you. If you have any questions, perhaps you can discuss them with the Deputy Commissioner at a break and ask any of those questions. And lastly, on my list, my fifth item is, it is Earth Day. April 22nd, 1970 was the first Earth Day. I happen to remember vividly my first Earth Day experience, and I thought I would share it with the group and ask you all if you have any Earth Day experiences. Not that I want to date anyone, but if you have an Earth Day experience that you can recall or that is particularly important in your life, I thought we'd just take a few minutes and talk about that, because this is a momentous day. If you remember all of the events leading up to Earth Day, including rivers being on fire and a whole host of federal legislative initiatives around cleaning up the polluted planet. This was one. So I was in sixth grade at Lexington Elementary School in Roseville, Minnesota, a school that is no longer present. I believe they had some significant asbestos remediation problems in part of that school that needed to be demolished. Anyway, our sixth grade class spent the lunch. As soon as we got done eating lunch, we went outside after lunch and picked up trash in the grounds of the school and the surrounding streets. And I can remember the kinds of things we picked up a lot were cigarette butts, a lot of piles of cigarette butts at the intersection of Lexington and County Road B, where people would pull over on the side of the road and dump their ash tray out of their car. And my, how things have changed. If I think about that experience, I can remember being down on our hands and knees picking up those cigarette butts out of the dirt. And that probably still happens nowadays, but not to the extent it did then, a lot less cigarette smoking going on. So that's my first Earth Day experience. And I wanted to just remind everyone, if you're inclined today, we will be breaking this meeting right about 11 to 11:15 so that we can go outside and clean up the grounds here again. So staff from the agencies and from the whole complex of agencies that are here in Lafayette Park, the Department of Human Services, the Department of Labor and Industry, the DNR and the PCA and the Board of Water and Soil Resources, will all be going out in teams to clean up the grounds. And if you're so inclined and want to help with that, we'll have gloves and trash bags and staff that can help you do that. So we'll take a break. If you want to change clothes, if you thought about that, you can, or you can just come out and participate however you like. But we welcome you to be a part of that cleanup event. Hopefully we'll be done with the meeting, but if we're not, we'll take a break between 1 and 1:30 because they're going to have a lunch for the volunteers in the cafeteria, and we'll head up there and sort of celebrate Earth Day with the team of folks that come together from the agencies in Lafayette Park to help out with that. So feel free to join. And then I would, as we go through items from board members, I thought you could all say something about Earth Day if you have something to share. And if you don't, that's fine too. You can pass. But that's the end of my report. Any items from board members?
No one's going to talk
now. Jim.
Well, I wasn't really prepared to think about my memories of Earth Days, but I don't have anything so vivid as your cigarette butt story. But I do remember a number of Earth Days of working with school kids. This is in southeast Minnesota, doing tree planting and some really good bonding going on there, but also quite a few roadside cleanups and just a great opportunity to be outdoors and to bond with other people on a common mission. So hopefully I'll be able to pitch in here today too. But great. I had a few items I just wanted to share, not that there are issues for MPCA, but more a matter of just disclosure.
Yep.
This coming Thursday, the Minnesota House Commerce and Consumer Protection committee will be having a hearing 8:45 a.m. on the bill to require the labeling of foods containing genetically engineered ingredients, and I'll be testifying, and I'll make it very clear that my comments don't represent the MPCA or the Soil and Water Conservation District of Winona County. But just wanted to bring that to your attention. Also, later, after we're done picking up trash, the Land Stewardship and another number of other groups are presenting petitions with over 6,000 signatures to Governor Dayton calling for a two-year moratorium on sand mining in southeast Minnesota. So I hope to get over and see some folks from my part of the state there. And then finally, just to let you know that May 7th through 15th, I'll be traveling to Iran and speaking. I've been invited to speak at an international organic agriculture conference and have been working with the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the State Department to make sure that this is all fully supported by our government, which it is. So I anticipate having a very eye-opening time, and they wanted to hear about U.S. organic regulations and organic marketplace, but of course couldn't get anybody from the U.S. government because we don't have relations, and so somehow they located me, and I reviewed the invitation. It looked like a very credible event based on some of the other speakers, and contacted the State Department, and they informed me that when they reviewed the invitation letter that this is consistent with U.S. foreign policy interests, and we've been doing a lot of soft diplomacy behind the scenes that we don't hear about at all. We've sent the U.S. Olympic wrestling team over for a big match over there, and the Iranians won, and then they sent their team over here, and they won again. I guess they're really big in
a huge sport
Greco-Roman
there, yeah.
wrestling, right? But also Philadelphia Orchestra has played there, and a team of seismologists from UC Berkeley are working with school districts there to make them earthquake-proof. So there's this soft diplomacy that is being supported, and I'm going to become part of that. So.
Wow. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you.
It's an interesting experience.
Right.
Look forward to the slideshow.
I hope to take a lot of slides. Besides this conference, I will get to visit some agricultural operations, which they first domesticated the goat 10,000 BC. I mean, this is an old agricultural, Persia.
Awesome. Great. Any other items from board members? Dr. Sampson looks ready.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, I don't know if we could follow on that. That was pretty impressive. But I would just say, Commissioner, that my experience was similar to yours in the first Earth Day, although I was in fifth grade, not sixth grade. So,
so we're a year apart.
And on the west side, I was in Fridley in a grade school that also no longer exists. But yeah, picking up all those things, I think it set an interesting tone for those of us who are about that age. Kind of really sticks in your mind thinking about the world you're going to grow up into, and was really interesting. And then, of course, you think through your life on other Earth Days, doing stream bed stabilization, planting trees, windbreaks, things like that. It's really kind of a neat way to have a day to celebrate, the progress we've made and look ahead to other opportunities we have. So,
great. Thank you. Anyone else? All right. Thanks, everyone. We'll move on to our, that completes the items by the board members, and we will move on to our decision item. And I believe we have our staff team here to present and welcome you all to the table and have you introduce yourselves and begin. Board members will expect to move first through the presentation by our staff, then we'll invite comments from anyone here who would like to make a comment. And for those of you who wish to speak, please fill out one of these green sheets over there on the table, bring it to the board secretary, and we'll make sure that you are given the opportunity to be heard. The other thing, board members, I want to make you aware of is We do have some handouts that were submitted previous to this meeting, but not in time to go into your packets, and we're going to have to accept those into the record, but I'll pass those out after the staff presentation is completed. So we'll have a couple of handouts to deliver to you once we're complete with the staff. Welcome. Please introduce yourselves.
Good morning, Board and Chairman. Happy Earth Day. My memory of Earth Day is 13 years ago, as I wasn't around for the first Earth Day, but planting about 8,000 trees on a crepe planting on my farm. It wasn't so much the planting that was memorable, it's the 8,000 steps around each of the tree to ensure that they are properly in the ground. But my name is Wayne Cords. I'm a feedlot supervisor here in the MPCA. Next to me is Kim Brinelson and Kevin Molloy. How do we... All right, so we're before you today to on a decision matter to discuss the amendments to the feedlot rules, amendments to the rules, namely Minnesota Chapter 7020. First off, I want to recognize and thank all the staff members listed here, along with Ann Cohen from the Attorney General's Office for all the hard work that they did. But not listed here, too, that I want to thank is all the public commenters, the stakeholders. Without them, you know, we get a rule, but sometimes it's not the best rule. So all their comments were well received, and we thank them for all their comments. But I also want to thank all the staff members listed here, as it was what we thought was going to be easy, targeted, no controversy rule revision turned out to be a little more than that. So I'll give you a little brief history. But first off, I want to make sure that everyone realizes that MPCA does recognize the value of animal agriculture in the state of Minnesota. It is an $8 billion industry here, and we recognize that it is important to our economy. So I want to make sure we're clear on that. And I also want to make sure the MPCA recognizes that we see the value of manure. It is a renewable resource. It is a soil amendment. It is a natural fertilizer that we do see the economic value of. It has all kinds of macro and micronutrients. It's an excellent soil amendment. And it's what we really need to have high-growing, high-yielding crops here in the state of Minnesota. So while people think manure is bad, we do recognize it does have good value to it. However, we also recognize that when manure is applied inappropriately or mismanaged, it can cause a drastic negative effect to surface and groundwaters here in the state of Minnesota, namely because the high biological oxygen demand, or BOD, the high nitrogen, the high phosphorus, or even the tremendous amounts of bacteria present in manure. So while it's good in soil, when used properly, it can have severe negative effects on ground and surface waters. So we have the feedlot rules, and there's permits authorized within the rules that provide a proactive method to regulate manure to prevent it from being a pollution hazard or a potential pollution hazard in the surface waters and groundwaters of the state of Minnesota. So in 1970s, you know, kind of coming thinking back to Earth Day here, we do have the adoption of the Clean Water Act. And in there, they designated feedlots as a point source, namely CAFOs, which is the term you'll hear quite often today, CAFO, confined animal feeding operation. And right now, that's designated by just sheer numbers of sizes. So for instance, for a swine facility, it's 2,500 head of swine is a large CAFO, 700 dairy cows, 55,000 turkeys or 125,000 chickens. So EPA, it's an EPA definition, and it's surely by size. So in the 1970s, they were designated as a point source. There wasn't much rules for it. At the same time, in the early 70s, the MPCA adopted their first rules regulating feedlots to prevent negative effects from manure. And at the same time, we also got delegated from the federal government to enforce the Clean Water Acts. So in the 70s, we had this initial little bit of regulation, not a whole lot. And then the 1990s came along. And in the 1990s, the feedlot sector saw this rapid consolidation of farms and expansion of numbers of animals on one single farm. Previous to this point, farms were generally, you know, what you envision in the 1950s. They had a few cows, a few chickens, a few pigs. They were very diverse in their animal species. But in the 90s, we saw a consolidation and an expansion of numbers. Now, this wasn't done on a whim. It is an effective and efficient manner of raising animals and animal products in the state of Minnesota. It is the most efficient way to do it. But this specialization didn't come without concerns and controversies. We went from smaller farms to larger farms, and with larger farms, more animals, you have more manure. We went from handling manure as a solid to handling it in liquid in these large basins. So there was a lot of controversy, a lot of concerns from neighbors and so forth. About 1998, the legislators recognized this controversy, and they adopted their first statute saying that all these large farms, over 1,000 animal units, and animal units, another term you're going to hear quite often today, it's just a equivalency number to compare apples to apples in the feedlot world. So it's based on a 1,000-pound animal. So if we think of a finishing pig, which weighs about 300 pounds, it's a 0.3 animal units. A dairy cow, which generally is about 100 or 1,400 pounds, maybe a little more, is given an increment number of 1.4. So it's just you hear animal unit, don't think head automatically. It's just the conversion to 1,000 pounds equals. So about this time, the legislator says, oh, we have this, you know, consolidation. We still see the value of it, but we want to make sure that we're operating these things in an efficient manner and in a safe manner for the environment. So they adopted that, they passed legislation saying that all these large farms had to have an NPDES permit if they met the 1,000 animal units or more threshold. And at the same time, we started to adopt new rules, and that brings us to 2000. And in 2000, we adopted the current feedlot rules. This is the comprehensive rules to prevent manure from causing pollution to the states. It went from a couple of pages to a fairly complex set of rules. But it is a good, straightforward process that producers can look at and understand where they need to go to permit and how to operate their farms in a safe and efficient manner. But also, it addressed all those concerns that were brought up in the late 90s from the neighbors and from the concerned citizens about these large facilities and how we're going to prevent pollution from entering waters of the state. And in the mid-2000s, EPA, because of several lawsuits at the federal level, decided that NPDES permits were no longer required for these large CAFO sites. So the federal law was challenged a couple times in a couple of courts throughout the nation, and the EPA decided they weren't going to allow or require permits for these CAFO sites until after they discharged. So it went from a proactive to a reactive type permit. Now, this is at the federal level. At the state level, the statute from 1998 was still there. We said, no, we still want that, the NPDES requirement. And then in 2000, the Minnesota state legislators revised that 1998 law and said, you only require to have a permit as required by federal law.
Excuse me, Mr. Court. You just said 2000, but you meant 2011?
Oh, 2011, I'm sorry.
Okay, just making sure you're
yep. tracking. In 2011.
Thank you.
Is in the special session. They originally talked about during the session, but it wasn't until the special session of 2011 that they passed this law. And what this law did is, so in 1998, it said NPDES permits were required for all large feedlots. So if they're over 1,000 animal units or defined as a CAFO, confined animal feeding operation, they're required to have this permit to operate, regardless if they are discharged or not. Because of the federal law change, and in the 2011 special session, they now said NPDES permits are only needed as required by federal law. This is not a statute that we initiated, but it did pass in the special session. Now, I also want to note that they said they're not required to have a permit, but if they choose, they may apply for an NPDES permit. So it didn't do away with the permit. It just says you're not required to have it, but if you choose to have it, because there is some pros to having this permit, and so they chose to put that in there that they could apply for if they wanted to. So this brings us to why we got to amend our current rules. The first and foremost is the 2011 special session legislation saying this permit, NPDES permit, is no longer required. This was an important permit in our rule, so we had to change the rule at this point. But as long as we were opening up the rule, there was some other minor rule changes or law changes that happened over the past 14 years that weren't big enough to warrant a whole rule change or to open up the rules. But as long as we had them open, we're going to change those. And we also had a number of housekeeping items, mainly to delete some obsolete rules, some that had some dates on it. The rules were passed in 2000. There was a lot of 2005, 2010 deadlines, in the rule that just needed to be taken out because they were no longer applicable. And, of course, anytime you write rules, you think you write the best possible language possible, everyone understands, After it comes out, someone always asks the question, well, what do you actually mean by this? So there was a few items that we had to clarify in our rules to make sure that, you know, it had been gone through the 14 years, that they were clear on what they meant. So those are the four items that we did. This revision was not a complete reopening of the rule. We really went in and just targeted those four items, and we didn't open up all the other aspects of it because it would be a much longer process, and we really need to address that NPDES permit requirement in the from the statute change. So the impact of the legislation and this proposed amendments to the rules is, for the most feedlots in the state, will not be impacted. They will not see a change in their permitting requirements. They will not see a change in their construction or expansion requirements, and they will not see a change in how they operate their facility. Most of the feedlots will not see any difference. However, the larger sites, the CAFO sites or sites over 1,000 animal units, will see a change because of the permit requirements. Now they must choose between the two permits, the previously required NPDES permit, or in existing rule, there was an SDS permit. For some reason, sometimes there were sites that didn't meet the requirement to have an NPDES permit, but the existing rules had an SDS permit, a state disposal system permit requirements, a state permit versus a federal permit. So the SDS permit was out of there. So now with the law change, they must choose between those two permits. And how they choose upon that is going to be a personal decision, because there is pros and cons to each of those permits. And they'll have to make sure that they understand what, you know, the risk is of each of the permits and what the, you know, the benefit of having one of the permits over the other. So it will be their decision on what permit they receive, the NPDES permit, the National Pollution Discharge Elimination System permit, or the state SDS permit, the state disposal system permit. Now, the only time we will tell them which permit they have to have is if they actually have a discharge, and then they're by law, federal law, they're required to have the NPDES permit. So then we'll say, you have a discharge, you're required to by federal law to have this permit, you shall have an NPDES permit. But up until the point they discharge, they can choose between their two permits if they're over that 1,000 animal unit threshold.
Can I just clarify for the record, Mr. Cords, the intention of all feedlot owners is to not have a discharge, right?
That is correct.
To manage their manure in such a way that it's a resource for adjoining farm fields and other uses that are beneficial, as you said, for soil amendment, for agronomic crop growth and all related things. So the just for clarity for board members who don't realize, discharge is an unintended, generally, occurrence on any feedlot. And so when we talk about discharge permits, the permit is as you said, and I just wanted to have you reiterate this, kind of an after, it can be a protective permit in the sense that here's how I'm going to operate my facility and what terms and conditions I'm going to apply to make sure that there's no discharge, or another form of a permit. I'm sure we'll get into this again when we get to the NPDES versus SDS permit. But just to set that up one more time, Mr. Cords, if you would, please.
Yes, Chairman, you're correct that it is not a all clear out discharge permit, that they are operating under a zero discharge standard. However, with anything, there is large storm events, there's accidents, and these permits, if they operate their facility as they are permitted for, they are given the opportunity to discharge in those extreme events without facing consequences for those actions. So if we get an 11-inch rainstorm, which seems to be a common occurrence lately in the state of Minnesota, that if they have a discharge, they're not held accountable for that discharge.
Thank you.
So the only time we will make that decision is if they are discharging during a time when we don't have a huge storm event, a 25-year, 24-hour rain event. If they are just discharging when it rains 1 inch, that is not going to be allowed. So then we would say you need the federal permit. But I also want to get very clear that even though there's revisions and some amendments to all these rules, the MPCA feels very strongly that these rules still protect the environment, that even all these changes that you're going to see today and for you, or these amendments before you today, they still are protective as a previous rule. I'm now going to turn over to Kevin Malloy, who is going to talk about the rule development process.
Yes, Mr. Chair, member of the board. My role in this rulemaking has been that of rulemaking coordinator. I joined the team in spring of 2012, and I am going to show you, this is about as concise a flowchart as I can create with the help of others here, in understanding what a rulemaking process goes through, because we want to focus the majority of the presentation on the content of the rule and some changes that were made as a result of the public input process. So I'm just going to run through this very quickly. If there are questions at the end of the presentation, any board members, Mr. Chair wants to ask any questions, please. I'm prepared to talk. We could talk as long as you want about it. But I think the intent is to get to the rule content here. So for any rulemaking, you will see the preliminary notice and the stakeholder meetings. That's kind of the kickoff. As Wayne identified, this rulemaking was kicked off as a result of the special session legislation in 2011. And I'm going to highlight some of the events that have taken place in my next slide about this. So you hear what's called a request for comments. That's the first formal publishing that any state agency must do in Minnesota. And all of these, by the way, are governed by Minnesota statutes at Chapter 14. It's commonly referred to as the Administrative Procedures Act. And the Office of Administrative Hearings has rules governing the procedure as well. And also the governor's office has a policy. There are three approvals back and forth from start to finish. We work with the executive branch. So that's how this starts, and outreach efforts are encouraged in the Administrative Procedures Act, and those took place with this rulemaking. We'll get into that. So that's the first box you're looking at. Second box, rule and SONAR development, executive branch and agency review. Minnesota is unique with the requirements to complete a rulemaking. SONAR stands for Statement of Need and Reasonableness. And so the burden is on the agency proposing rules or proposing amendments to existing rules, which is the case today. You have to identify that all of the rules in total are necessary and reasonable, and there are criteria for doing so. And then each amendment has to have a rule-by-rule justification as being necessary and reasonable. Note that that doesn't say the best. It's hard to come up with agreement as to what's the best, but the judge, this process culminates with an administrative law judge's review, and they have that burden of they've got their criteria for determining necessary and reasonableness. So enough said on the SONAR, I think. Well, let me just say one other thing. Part of that is notification requirements. There are several in the Administrative Procedures Act in terms of notifying certain legislators, certain affected parties, et cetera. And also economic impacts, cost-benefit analysis, if you will. Okay? So that's all detailed in a SONAR. It has to be. Then when you get your rules the way you want them and with stakeholder input, you get them on formal notice. You have to do that in the state register. You have to send notifications to several folks who are registered with your agency. And in terms of, we use Gov Delivery Service now, most agencies do. But if somebody requests snail mail, they can get a hard copy of the notice sent. And these days we're maximizing the use of the web, so we're steering people to the rulemaking web page. Some of you have perhaps visited that for this particular rulemaking. The formal notice, you have choices. In this instance, we used a dual notice, which means the agency had scheduled a public hearing to take place if 25 valid requests were received requesting a public hearing. If we would not have received those requests, there would not be a need for a public hearing. And once you exceed that threshold, that's where there's a statute that governs this board that says any decisions on adopting rules must be made by the citizens board, just so we're clear on that. So the public hearing takes place. That's convened with an administrative law judge. And the formal comment period usually lasts 30 days. Public hearing takes place. I like to look at that as an extension of the comment period. Folks who maybe didn't comment before are still allowed to do so. Post-hearing comments, that's all in written form. Folks who maybe didn't want to testify but have something to say are still allowed to bring up something that maybe hasn't come up yet during the post-hearing comment period. And then that's usually, it's anywhere from 5 to 20 calendar days. A judge usually will extend it to 20 days if the agency feels it needs that time. And we respond during that time period as well. And then there's also a rebuttal period. So enough said on that. And the next box, the administrative law judge does their review. Sometimes they have questions, and we as staff provide them any information, you know, anything that's unclear in the public hearing record. After the report comes out, we bring it to you for a final determination. With this rulemaking, this is the last approval that is required at this point. All of the governor's approvals have been acquired, and so this board, presuming an affirmative directive is made today, then we proceed by submitting the order adopting to the Office of Administrative Hearings, and in about another 3 to 4 weeks, the notice of final adoption will be published in the State Register. The rules become effective 5 working days after that. Okay. This is just a very quick highlighting. So that very first box I mentioned, the preliminary notice request for comments. With this rulemaking, that happened in December 2011. Public informational meetings we distributed. Actually, it was the three of us in Mankato. We had put together draft rules, wanted stakeholder input. Between those two meetings, 30 individuals attended the meetings and gave us some helpful feedback. The rules were then finalized and published in the State Register, that dual notice that I mentioned, on July 22nd of 2013. We did receive over the required threshold for a public hearing to be held. Most of those came by way of a form letter, and the bar is kind of is low in the Administrative Procedures Act in terms of a valid request for a public hearing to be held. You can oppose the rules in total. You don't have to give a line-by-line justification as why you want the hearing to be held. It just said, I oppose these rules in total and believe that this needs to go to a public hearing. So we exceeded that threshold. The form letters, I think we received up to 60 approximately. All of this information's in your packet. I don't want to reiterate things that you've already read. But again, if you have questions after presentation. Something that I think is worth emphasizing, on the public hearing that was held on September 9th, it was both an afternoon and evening session. It was an interactive video conference statewide. And with the exception of our Duluth regional office, we held folks out in the regional parts of the state, outside of the metropolitan area. We're very appreciative of that. They were able to go to the nearest office, and if they wanted to testify during the hearing, they did so. So that worked out very well, efficiency-wise. Then the post-hearing comment period, the judge did extend it up to the full 20 days, and then according to the judge's report, she took all of the comments and summarized them as basically approximately 32 comments of substance, not excluding those form letters that I mentioned, were received during the comment period, the hearing, and the post-hearing process. So The report, which was issued, and you have that in your packet, that's attachment number 5, December 2nd, approved most of what the agency was proposing. And in particular, I think it needs emphasizing, or is worth emphasizing, that there was some testimony received regarding the authority of the agency to require the SDS permit. And that was dealt with in the administrative law judge's report. So that was found to be something we are well within our statutory authority of requiring. Disapproved 12 of the proposed amendments, 5 of which were the same. It was the use of combining the NPDES/SDS permit. The administrative law judge did not like that in her report. She identifies why, and Kim's going to elaborate that on that point in just a minute here. So when they disapprove, when an administrative law judge disapproves any amendments, they usually prescribe a prescription for if they think it's fixable in a way that would address we saw the terms impermissibly vague in some of the they call them defects when they disapprove an amendment, and so she did. Administrative Law Judge Riley did that with most of these, not all of them, and then we ended up proposing alternatives in a few instances, and so that requires additional back and forth with the Office of Administrative Hearings. That took place, and we sent that. That's in your packet as well, our back and forth. You could see the development of the rule changes. And on the 24th of February, the Chief Administrative Law Judge Poost made her determination that, yes, the agency's fixes, if you will, to these defects were satisfactory, and except for one, and that dealt with the proposed definition of owner. And again, Kim is going to get into that. Let me just say that the agency has since withdrawn that particular, the one amendment that was not approved to remedy this. So all of the amendments that are in front of you right now have been approved by the Chief Administrative Law Judge. That sums up my portion of the presentation. I'm going to turn it over to Kim Brynjolfsson now.
Thank you, Mr. Malloy. And Ms. Brynjolfsson.
Good morning. My name is Kim Brynjolfsson. I am the lead engineer for the feedlot program, and I was also the technical coordinator for this rule revision. My presentation today will focus on the controversial rule amendments and the final resolution of these issues. Most of the amendments were not commented on and will not be discussed here today. And for a full discussion of the amendments, you can refer to your board packet. To address the changes made, the change summary of the changes we made, as Wayne had pointed out, are the changes that were needed to address the issuance of the NPDES permit based on federal law. We also added the changes made to state and federal laws that occurred since we last revised the rules in 2000. And we also deleted the outdated language and clarified some of the rules. To address the changes made to Minnesota Statute 16.07, it was necessary to amend the rule for NPDES permits to require an NPDES permit only if there is a discharge from the feedlot. There's also the requirement within the existing requirement in the rules for SDS permits that require a permit, SDS permit, for any facility with 1,000 animal units or more. There was no change to this portion of the rule. However, we received several comments from producer groups stating that it was the intent of the statutory amendment to no longer require any operating permits for large feedlots. The result of this issue is that, as Kevin pointed out, the judge did agree that MPCA has the authority to issue SDS permits, and we will continue to issue and require SDS permits for all large feedlots with 1,000 animal units or more. Another amendment that was made to the rule is the addition of a definition of waters of the United States, which is based on the definition of waters of the United States that can be found in the Clean Water Act. This definition was added because the amended statute states that MPCA can only issue NPDES permits as required by federal law, and federal law requires that a permit have an NPDES permit if there is a discharge to waters of the United States. We received several comments pertaining to this definition, stating that there's no specific definition for waters of the United States within the Clean Water Act, and that the Code of Federal Regulations should be used instead. We knew at the time that we developed the rules that the Environmental Protection Agency was in the process of establishing a rule to clarify what constitutes waters of the United States, and this rule has been released last month for a 90-day comment period. Because the definition has been in a state of flux, we were hesitant to reference the Code of Regulations. To rectify this issue, the definition for waters of the United States has been added to the feedlot rules in such a way that it references the Code of Regulations, but also will allow for any changes that occur to the definition within the Code of if the Code of Federal Regulations is changed, it will not impact the way the definition of waters of the United States is in within the feedlot rules.
Mr. Riddle.
Should we ask questions as we go along or hold our questions?
I think let's try to hold questions and try to get through the presentation, and then we'll circle back on any questions.
Right.
Thank you.
Sounds good.
We also added, as I said, other statutory changes that occurred since the last rule revision, and one of these applies to the definition of pasture. This definition is important in the feedlot rules because the MPCA has no regulatory authority over pastures, so clear understanding is needed as to what is a feedlot or an animal holding area, when is an animal holding area a feedlot, and when is it a pasture. Sometimes it's kind of hard to tell. There are currently two statutes that define pastures as well as an existing definition in the feedlot rule. To include all applicable state requirements into one place for clarity in the proposed rule, we combined the existing rule definition with the statutory definitions of pasture. We further defined a term that's used in the statutory definitions of concentration of animals, and because there was nothing in the statute that explains what this term means. In amending the rule to incorporate the statutes, we added this phrase. We added an explanation of this phrase that was based on agronomic rates, which is a commonly used term in the feedlot rule. The comments we received on this amendment stated that the legislative language of the statute should be used without further clarification in a rule. We then amended our proposed rule such that it contains only the language that is found in the statutes and the existing rule. Three other statutory changes pertaining to feedlots that occurred since 2000 include no permit required for certain small feedlots. There are neighbor notifications for construction or expansion of feedlots with 500 animal units or more, and there are restrictions on the separation distance to shoreland. There were no comments on any of these amendments. We made a number of amendments to the rule to add clarity. Some of these are rule language that is awkward and hard to understand, requirements that did not get addressed fully during the 2000 rule revision, or issues that have come up in the past 14 years that are not covered in the existing rules. These clarifications include the processing of applications and permits, including permit modifications, whether to define the NPDES permit as NPDES or NPDES/SDS, and the owner definition. They also apply to discharge to subsurface waters an emergency carcass disposal plan, and liquid manure storage area design and construction. The current rule does not include a definition or specific requirements for modifying an existing permit for feedlots. However, there are requirements for modification of National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System or State Disposal System permits in Minnesota Rules Chapter 7001. The question of whether a change to a feedlot is considered a major or minor modification according to Chapter 7001 has been debated several times in recent years. Although since this requirement is not specifically found in the feedlot rules, it is often not apparent to a feedlot owner that a permit modification is required for the changes they are planning to make to their feedlot. For this reason, we added a definition for modification and feedlot permit-specific requirements to the rule. The proposed definition resulted in several comments, which stated that the definition is vague and the need for a permit amendment could cause significant delays for the owner.
The final rule resulted in the feedlot-specific definition for major and minor modifications, as well as identifying certain feedlot changes that would require no permit amendment. The proposed amendments to the rule also include a change to the reference to the term NPDES, or National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System permits, from to a combined National Pollutant Discharge Elimination / State Disposal System permit to indicate that all NPDES permits issued by the MPCA, not only for feedlots but also for industrial and municipal facilities, are actually a combination of a federal NPDES permit and a state SDS permit. Since the MPCA is responsible for administration of both of these permits and the permittee is responsible for complying with both federal and state requirements, the MPCA has been using the combined NPDES-SDS permits since the 1970s. This method of permitting simplifies permit administration for the MPCA and provides all applicable state and federal regulations into a single permit document for the, and simplifies the process for both the MPCA and the permittee. Comments regarding this amendment stated that in using the term NPDES-SDS for federal permit, the MPCA would be using this permit as a backdoor method for adding federal requirements into the SDS permit. This resulted in the dropping of this proposed amendment, and we will, and the rule now, the proposed rule now simply says NPDES permit. The existing rules contains a definition for owner, which identifies an owner as a person having possession, control, or title to a feedlot. However, there are permit application requirements within the existing rule that apply to people who are proposing to construct a new feedlot or purchase an existing feedlot and do not actually own the feedlot at that time. To address this, an amendment was added to the definition for owner that included persons who proposed to own the feedlot. Concern was expressed that this proposed amendment might cause future buyers, lenders, or heirs to feel compelled to submit a permit application. To address this concern, the proposed amendment has been dropped, and there is no change to this portion of the rule. In recent years, MPCA staff have dealt with a number of feedlots that have experienced a catastrophic event, such as a flood, tornado, or fire, which has resulted in the death of a significant number of animals. The disposal of carcasses, in most cases, has been a problem partially due to the short amount of time available for determining the most environmentally sound disposal method. To address this concern, the rules were modified to include an addition of to the existing requirement for an emergency response plan for feedlots with 1,000 animal units or more that would require that the feedlot owner include a plan for emergency carcass disposal result due to a catastrophic event to their emergency response plan. Comments that were received stated that the MPCA does not have the authority over the disposal of carcasses and that that is actually within the Board of Animal Health's jurisdiction. We discussed this and argued that the pollutants that result from the improper disposal of carcasses contain significant pollutants to either surface or groundwaters, and those that does fall within the MPCA's jurisdiction. The administrative law judge did approve this amendment. The existing feedlot rules contain a large section that addresses the construction and operation of liquid manure storage areas, or LMSAs. But there's no definition within the rule as to what an LMSA is. A liquid manure storage area is a constructed container used to store liquid manure. It's as simple as that. And is commonly a poured concrete pit that is located below a barn, such as kind of like a basement in the barn, under the barn's about 8 feet deep, or a basin similar to a municipal wastewater treatment pond, only much deeper, and usually not as large a surface area, that is excavated into the ground and lined with compacted soil. But it can also include small tanks that are used to collect runoff from feed storage areas or open lots as a result of a rain event and then pump it to a larger manure storage area. It can also, or a shallow basin that is used to collect runoff from an open lot and release it through a controlled structure to, for a short period of time, to a grass filter strip. Because these smaller types of liquid manure storage areas are used for a short period of time, there is a limited environmental risk and do not need to be held to the same design standards as liquid manure storage areas that will hold several million gallons of manure for up to 9 months. For this reason, we developed a rule amendment that includes an exemption for a portion of the design requirements for these small types of LMSAs. The comments we received stated that the exemption was not adequately defined and that the MPCA would have too much discretion. We further modified this portion of the rule to include specific types of liquid manure storage areas, and this amendment has been approved. The current rules requires that depending upon the type of liner used in the LMSA, that there is to be a separation distance of 5 to 20 feet from the bottom of a liquid manure storage area to bedrock. Recently, and this applies to the bedrock that we find in the southeastern part of Minnesota known as the karst region. Recently, the MPCA has received proposals to achieve the separation distance necessary by removing bedrock and filling in the area with soil. At the time the rules were last revised, this practice was not considered, and there are currently no existing rules that apply to this situation. To address this need, the rules have been amended to allow the removal of bedrock to construct a liquid manure storage area based on an established set of criteria. Comments we received stated that the removal of bedrock should not be allowed at all, and that the MPCA has too much discretion. The proposed amendment was approved by the administrative law judge.
The rule was also amended to clarify the type of discharges that are prohibited to groundwater by expanding the list of ways that manure could be transferred to groundwater to include other direct conduits. The comments we received indicated that it would give the MPCA too much discretion and that the term conduit was unclear. We modified the term conduit to be natural or constructed channels that convey fluids. And this has been approved. As mentioned before, we also took this opportunity to do some housekeeping changes to the rule, including removing obsolete language that pertaining to permit applications, open lot agreements, and unapproved liquid manure storage areas, and correcting references to other state and federal requirements contained in the feedlot rule. We also updated the document contained in the documents that are contained in the list of incorporated by reference, and we fixed the errors in punctuation, grammar, and alphabetical order. As stated before, there are several other amendments that were made to the rule, but we did not receive any comments to these amendments, and they have not been mentioned in this presentation. The information provided during this presentation and contained in the board packet demonstrates that staff have followed the required procedures for amending the feedlot rule. It has been brought to our attention by Mr. Gary Cook in the letter we received this week that there are two errors within the findings of fact and order of rule adoption. That is attachment one to your board packet. The first correction is to attachment one is on page 6, item 7F. And this should read as it does on the slide, with the exception that where it said the first part of the red overlined portion says subpart one, permit required, that part will remain. But the rest of the text, starting with four types of permits are issued under this chapter, needs to be removed from the findings. The change that was referenced here is not being made to the rule. A second correction can be found on page 7 of attachment 1 in item 7G, and that has to do with in item B of subpart 2, the reference there to NPDS/SDS, as I stated in my presentation, we're not making that change. We're leaving it as it currently exists in the rule. So it should just be NPDS, not NPDS/SDS. At this time, the staff recommends that the board approve the two changes to the findings of fact and order of rule adoption, and that the board adopt the suggested staff resolution authorizing the commissioner or his authorized designee to sign the amended findings of and order adopting rules. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brynaldson. And I know we'll have some questions from board members. So, Mr. Riddle, I know you had a question on slide 14 on the waters of the United States.
Right.
I expect you had a question on slide 23 on bedrock removal as well.
Right.
If I'm reading your body language correctly. So yeah. Let's take your questions first, Mr. Riddle, and then we'll see what other questions board members have.
You missed some of my body language because I also was, I know this is not open for change right now, but just thinking about the you know, acronym SDS with the D standing for disposal. When we've talked about the nutrient value of these livestock byproducts, essentially, and so, you know, in the future, we might look at least changing it to discharge, but really it's resource management. So just a comment there.
Thank you.
In reviewing the materials for today, this Waters of the U.S., I didn't find where the language in what I'm hearing now is still a draft in the Code of Federal Regulation, hasn't been settled on at the federal level, but it's referenced here in these proposed changes to the CFR number, but I didn't find where the actual language in the CFR exists.
Okay.
So that's the first question, is just, what is that language?
And Mr. Cords, maybe you can, I know we have a slide on this, but I know that the EPA has announced their proposed rule is going to be released by June 1, if I recall correctly. Am I right on that? I'm looking to our staff.
It's already published.
It's published. All right. So then I'm thinking of the other one. All right. So there is a draft of the language, but perhaps we can address what the draft rule says.
Yeah, that'd be helpful.
All right. Mr. Cords or Kim, whichever of you.
The draft feedlot rule?
Yep. No. The draft definition in the feed of the Clean Water Act for waters of the U.S.
Chairman, it's the Code of Federal Regulations, Title 40, Section 122.2.
Okay.
So that's where it comes from. Knowing that we wrote these rules and that there was always this definition, but not very clear definition by the federal government, we wanted to write it so that as they change it, we can change ours without opening up our rules again. So that's why, excuse me, you see it kind of vague in ours, but because these permits are only acquired by federal law when they discharge to waters of the United States, we are leaving that definition to them to define. So it is a little bit catchy, and that's why, you know, that part of the choosing the permit, which permit they want to do, if they get the NPDES permit regardless, they are covered from that having a discharge to the waters of the state because they're covered under the permit already. So that vagueness in there, which even if they adopt these rules at the federal government, it's one court case away from changing again. So it's always going to be a flux movement of what is waters of the United States.
Thank you, Mr. Cords. I know Ms. Cohen has joined the table, so Ms. Cohen from the Attorney General's Office, if you could introduce yourself and maybe add some additional response to this question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ann Cohen, Assistant Attorney General. I'll try to take a whack at this question and hopefully clarify what is a very confusing issue. When the state government required the MPCA to issue permits under federal law, that had the unfortunate effect of importing into our state law situation what has been a very controversial issue for more than 10 years on the federal level, which is to say, what is the jurisdiction of EPA under the Clean Water Act? When EPA first adopted rules to implement the Clean Water Act, it created a definition of waters of the United States. And it was a very broad definition. Whereas the legislative language had used the term navigable waters, the US EPA took that term and made it waters of the United States and included isolated wetlands and other very important waters in terms of interstate commerce, because they provide important habitat and water retention and groundwater recharge and et cetera, all of which are very important to the economy of the United States in the view of EPA and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. But that term, waters of the United States, was challenged as being broader than the statutory term, which was navigable waters. So there were a number of court cases that eventually worked their way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. This happened in early 2000 era. There were two decisions that emerged from the U.S. Supreme Court. Unfortunately, these were plurality opinions, which means there was no majority of justices voting for any one opinion on the case. And so no clear, quote unquote, legal test emerged from these U.S. Supreme Court opinions. And since that time, it is fair to say there has been confusion and delay in the federal system because no one is sure whether a particular water is or is not subject to the Clean Water Act. And what the Clean Water Act says, of course, is you cannot discharge into a navigable water or water in the United States without a permit, but we don't know where these waters are. And now that the state has to essentially apply the federal standard in its state NPDES program, we are faced with the same dilemma of what is a water United States. The definition that's currently found in 40 CFR 122.2 is not the one that's being applied because these U.S. Supreme Court cases have told us that, well, we're not sure what the standard is, but at least it's not that broad rule definition that EPA created. So a bit of a dilemma when we're doing this rule because our state permits cannot authorize a discharge to waters of the United States. Only the federal government NPDES permit, which we implement for them in the state, can do that. So what to do? We proposed initially a definition that was extremely broad, which said, well, the definition of waters of the United States is whatever it is under the Clean Water Act. That's what we proposed to try to solve this dilemma. Commenters quite correctly pointed out, as we already knew, that, well, we don't know what that is. So that's not a very good definition. Well, you know, we can't disagree with them on that. It's true. It's not a very good definition, but because this is all a boil on the federal level, we don't really know what is a good definition. The administrative law judge recommended, I think actually wisely as it turned out, why don't you go back to the 40 CFR 122.2 definition, even though we know that's not exactly what's being applied today, because under our state law, vis-a-vis the revisor's office, which controls our rules, if we adopt a federal definition, which is then changed in the future, that new definition, whatever it is, will attach to our rules. And we realized, well, as EPA is currently, as of March 2014, trying to change this definition, we will get whatever it is that emerges out of that process. So in a year or two, which is what it's going to take, because they will literally get thousands of comments on this proposal, we will know, hopefully, finally, what the definition is of waters of the United States, which we can then apply in our state system as we determine who needs a federal NPDES permit and who does not. I'm sorry that was so long-winded.
I don't think it was long-winded, Ms. Cohen. I think it's just the way the challenge of the Clean Water Act definition of waters of the U.S. is. And so thank you for that. Mr. Riddle?
Yeah, thank you for the background and the rationale there, which I totally get. But I come back to my question, which is, in these proposed rules, which are currently open for public comment, is the term waters of the United States defined? And if so, could you please read that to us?
The definition, if your board packet, I think, does contain the proposed,
I couldn't find it.
Proposed rule. It's subpart 27. It's found on page 7
of attachment 2.
Of attachment 2. And unfortunately, I don't think you'll find it particularly illuminating because it simply says waters of the United States has a meaning given under Code of Federal Regulations Title 40 Section 122.2.
Right. That's what prompts my
right.
question.
Oh, what does that say currently?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I don't know that we actually
have to. Just a second here. I do have
it's a rather lengthy. It's a rather lengthy definition currently under federal rule. So, you know, it goes on and it describes a variety of waters that are subject to federal definition.
We do not. Currently, I believe that new in attachment 2, is that not subpart 27? Is that what the new definition?
He wants the 122.
He actually wants the definition. So
the federal rule.
If we have a live connection on our internet, we could go out and find the Code of Federal Regs definition and show it on the screen, I think is what Member Riddle would like.
That would be helpful. Yeah, and if we need to comment on it, we should have a heads up. I mean, if it's open for public comment to EPA right now and it's inappropriate or whatever, we should be aware of what they're proposing, mm-hmm. especially since we're fixing to reference it.
Yep. So we are members of the public and the agency are anticipating and have indicated its desire to make comments. So we are interested in a offering that opportunity to board members because it is open for comment by the federal government right now. You're correct. So can someone locate? Mr. Malloy's got closest access to the mouse and the keyboard.
Okay.
To jump into the internet and find us the Code of Federal Regulations.
I'll give it a try here. Okay.
All right, let's do that. Deputy Commissioner Beeman will go while you guys are organizing your materials. She'll find the appropriate reference material and bring it to us, because otherwise I think we're gonna be bouncing around on screens too much confusion. So let's come back to that, Mr. Riddle. Let's move on. Did you have another question? I think.
I do.
Let's go to your next question.
I have two. Just one on this definition of pasture. Just to be clear, if I'm reading this right, that as currently proposed, well, actually, it appears that it even is already the definition of pasture without the small change that's being proposed here. A cornfield, if it's winter grazed, would qualify as a pasture. Is that correct?
Mr. Cords?
That is correct. As long as they're grazing in that cornfield. The intent of the statute was never to have a cornfield turn into a feedlot, but if they're out there grazing in it and consuming the stover that's left over in the corn, yes, that is allowed. Once that's removed or all that's gone and it becomes a feedlot where there's no longer grazing, then that's where we come into that. When does it become a pasture, or when it's become pasture to feedlot? So, yes, allowing of grazing on corn stalks is allowed.
And it's even defined as a pasture.
Yes.
Yeah. Just comment, I mean, that does not fit my common sense definition or understanding of a pasture. But then my other question is about the removal of bedrock in the karst region and the allowance for construction of a manure-holding pit after bedrock has been removed. Is that, and I could probably find this answer myself, but is that only a concrete pit, or could there still be an earthen lined pit in the karst region after the removal of bedrock?
Mr. Cords.
I'll let Kim answer that since she's the engineer in this matter.
Thanks, Ms. Brittleson.
Commissioner, Mr. Riddle, the removal of bedrock is actually not allowed unless they meet the criteria that are found in the rules. They can remove the liners that we have seen have been proposed as actually a composite liner, where they have a synthetic layer covered by concrete. But we've also seen over the years where they have done their soil investigation and have not, during the soil investigation, they did not identify any bedrock. But then as they started their excavation, they discovered some bedrock that they needed. And so it kind of also addresses that concern. We can't just blanket say you can't do it, because there is situations where, you know, they're in the middle of their construction, they're building their barns, they've already invested so much money into the project, then they find this bedrock. We can't just say you have to stop. So,
well, you could.
But
I mean, that does call into question the original engineering.
Right.
The soil investigation, these structures sometimes, you know, could be, you know, like 300 feet wide and 400 feet long. And they do the soil investigations usually on about a 50-foot grid. And it's possible that they just missed that one part.
So, Mr. Riddle, was your question about, I thought your question pertained to construction. Would it allow for compacted soil basins versus concrete?
Right.
And so what's the answer to that question, Ms. Riddle?
So, that, as I said, that would likely not require simply a compacted soil, but also the bedrock is replaced by compacted soil, and then there would be a liner above that, and that likely would require what we call a composite liner, and that's made up of, say, earthen and synthetic, or earthen and concrete, or concrete with the synthetic, so it's like a double liner.
So any combination of those would be acceptable, but not a simple compacted soil liner?
No.
Right. Just about anywhere in the karst region on the ridges, within 3 feet, you're into bedrock.
Yes.
That's pretty predictable.
Yes.
So, and then you don't know where the sinkholes are going to open up, but there's fissures everywhere. That's just the nature of karst. So
Mr. Riddle and Ms. Brittleson, what we did in this circumstance and the rule was incorporate sort of some technical guidance that we developed internally to address these very site-specific field conditions that emerge during construction. So this is, to your point, Mr. Riddle, I think it represents a compromise between prohibition of construction of a liquid manure storage area in karst versus highly controlled, if you will, or standardized approaches to address it. So that's my characterization for the, if that's accurate, Ms. Brindleton, I appreciate it.
Mr. Commissioner, yes, that's accurate. We're also, one of the other items we would consider is the development of a groundwater monitoring plan for the structure.
Thank you. Other questions from board members? Very good. I'd like to thank the staff. Did we find the definition? It looks like we did.
Yes.
Mr. Malloy.
Yes. So what we have on this tab, starting right here, is the existing definition of waters of the United States at this. This is the definition that is linked in the...
Can you increase the...
I'll see if I can make it a little bit bigger.
That's pretty good.
That's okay.
It's pretty legible.
And if you like, I can scroll down further. So this is existing, and then here is the link to the proposed rule here, Waters of the United States. I don't know how much of this you want to you would prefer to get into reading, scrolling down, et cetera.
Mr. Riddle, just maybe for clarity now, return to what your question was and what you're hoping to see, which is the current rule is there plus the EPA's proposal for the rule.
Yeah, I really appreciate this and would just like a chance to quickly read through all these points there that are being proposed.
Okay. Proposed, not existing.
Well,
this what we're looking at right now is the current Code of Federal Regulation definition of waters of the U.S.
Okay.
Then the second tab, which he's opened, is the Federal Register publication, which speaks to the proposed rule revision or Code of Federal Reg revision.
And that's the one that's named by reference in what we're considering today. The CFR.
Actually, the CFR, the former, is the one that's named.
Okay.
And
but it is
this one is
to
the
change.
Proposed, yes.
Yeah. Okay.
As it will be probably as soon as it's adopted.
Yeah.
In a couple of years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So just for clarity, let me just summarize what this discussion of waters of the United States has. I've had a rather engaging career in definitions of this sort in my previous life at DNR as a hydrologist as well. But the current Code of Federal Regulation provides for this language that says what waters of the United States means. It is currently open for comment as far as a proposed change to that definition. The definition changes that come as a result of several lawsuits. But for the sake of our rule, as Ms. Cohen stated, when we were limited to applying the Federal Clean Water Act requirements for NPDES permits, we're limited to waters of the United States definition. So we had to import this definition into our rule, though it is unclear what it will be. So the point that I just want to return to is, lacking any other alternative, we're bound by what current federal regs are. We're not able to modify it. However, if they are modified, the rule says, the proposed rule that we're going to act on today says that we will abide by the future definition of that Code of Federal Regulation as well. So we are necessarily tied to it because of the action of the legislature and the rules that the law judge has said needs to be clear how we're going to relate. Ms. Cohen would like to slightly improve my discussion.
Mr. Commissioner and members of the board,
Ms. Cohen.
In the staff memo to the board, you'll note that we very carefully state that we are aware that the current definition that the ALJ recommended that we adopt into our rule from the CFR 122.2, we are aware that courts have undermined the applicability of that definition. Therefore, in applying the definition, this agency will be mindful of those court decisions. And I think that what that means essentially is it will be a case-by-case determination, which is what the courts are doing today in trying to decide where the federal government has jurisdiction and where it does not. So to be colloquial, we're in the swamp. We have soft footing. We're going to walk carefully. We're going to try to use our common sense and good judgment in applying this definition in our rules. We will, in all likelihood, be very mindful and not try to apply this definition of waters of the United States in areas where the Supreme Court tests, such as they are, would suggest that it is not applicable.
Thank you. Mr. Riddle.
Well, I mean, it's obvious that it's a fluid situation. I appreciate the difficulty in trying to define waters of the U.S. and what's subject to, you know, statute, et cetera. All waters are global. I mean, they're constantly on the move. It's either running, seeping, or evaporating, you know. I think about, okay, so it seems clear that the Mississippi River is a water of the U.S. From this definition. But what about the tributaries in southeast Minnesota that feed directly into the Mississippi River? How far in practical terms does federal jurisdiction reach and the state take over?
Mr. Commissioner, if I could,
Ms. Cohen,
comment on that. What the board memorandum states, and what I think is true, is within the state of Minnesota, most waters of the state, which is a defined term for state law purposes, very broad, and waters of the United States will be coextensive because we are a blessedly watery state with a lot of connected waterways, and we do not have a lot of very questionable, isolated waters in this state. It is possible that there are some, and it's possible that there are some very intermittent streams that would not meet the definition of waters of the United States. But the staff position is that in most cases, waters of the United States and waters of the state will be coextensive. So in most areas of the state, if you are locating a feedlot with a liquid manure storage area and you are concerned about the discharges that could happen if that design storm is exceeded, you would probably be well advised to get the federal permit, because the water to which your discharge will run will likely be one of those navigable waters that is a water of the United States.
And Ms. Cohen, I know that we could sit here and ponder these definitions quite some time, but I just want to caution board members that these are heavily litigated terms across the nation. So reliance on sort of our own, I've done this in the past myself, my own hydrologic training to infer hydrologic rationale to a legal term can be a dangerous endeavor. So caution is all I would advise, and we will do our best to exercise caution and get legal input as well as hydrologic input when we make decisions about how we will apply these definitions, and that's probably as far as I ought go.
Right, and it is fair to say, if I make one more comment, that the definition that the U.S. EPA has proposed retains some of this scientific analysis. They have named certain waters that are going to be waters in the United States, but then they have also retained something of the nature of the Supreme Court test, the nexus and the connectivity, et cetera, in their definition, so that there will be case-by-case, in theory, science-based determinations going forward of which waters are or aren't. Now, whether that's going to be helpful to us, I don't know, but that is what they have decided to do. And I will make a second prediction here, is that there will be more litigation once this definition is actually proposed.
Thank you. Let's move on to the two letters that we received, and then I have a request from Matt Berger to speak as well. So what I'd like to do is just distribute these letters, board members, to you. The first is from law firm of Gislason and Hunter, received last Friday from Gary Cook, and we'll pass these down. And this bit of correspondence pertains to a couple of the findings of fact that Ms. Brynaldson pointed out to us have been identified for correction. And so with your, by motion, I would ask a member of the board to accept this into the record for today's hearing. Mr. Jensen moves. Is there a second?
I second.
Second by Ms. Drager. This letter, as I said, is explaining some technical corrections on our board packet. And we can have further discussion, but on the motion, all those in favor of accepting this into the record signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Same sign. Letter's accepted. Now, any comments from the staff on the letter? Ms. Brynaldson or Mr. Cords or Ms. Cohen?
Commissioner, would you prefer to have, I know Mr. Berger is here from the Gislason Law Firm. Would you prefer to hear Mr. Berger speak and then have us respond, or would you like us to respond right away? Because we certainly can explain the nature of the comment and then what our response to that would be.
But yeah, why don't we do that, and then Mr. Berger can add additional comments if he feels necessary. But what I heard Ms. Brynaldson say was that two of the findings in our board packet were in error, or there were technical corrections required to match the record from the administrative law judge. And so I just wanted to be clear that the main points of Mr. Cook's letter did accomplish those things. Are there other things that we should take from this letter, Ms. Cohen? Or
Mr. Commissioner, members of the board, there were the two corrections for which we thank the Gislason Law Firm very much for their good proofreading, and we thank them for that. There was a substantive challenge as well. Now, Ms. Brynjolfsson remarked on the fact that the initial staff proposal for amending this rule, we had proposed to change the name in the rule, NPDES, to reflect what has been historically this agency's practice in all its water quality permitting programs. All MPCA NPDES permits are called NPDES/SDS. And the reason for that is that, for one thing, there is a separate state requirement to get a permit, and the agency wants the regulated community to understand that in getting an NPDES permit, the requirement to obtain a state permit has also been satisfied. So no worries, right? We want you to understand that this permit that you're getting is everything that you need. But also because by existing state law and rule, there are some state permit conditions that have to be met, and these are included in NPDES permits. So again, now this slide shows you there is existing rule. In your existing, the Chapter 7000 rules, you have to find in issuing any permit that it will meet both federal and state law. And there's also a rule that says, essentially, that NPDES permits should contain any state law permits that are required. So as a result, the NPDES permit has always been called, even in the feedlot program, since the beginning, an NPDES/SDS permit. And this was without any controversy until our staff team decided that it would be a good idea to call it what it's called in the permit world in the rule. And this evidently was controversial. And the ALJ finally recommended, well, why don't you just keep the existing name? Because she recognized that there was a state rule that says, well, if you get the NPDES permit, you have satisfied the need to get the SDS permit. So we aren't playing any fancy game here with the permit. It's always contained state conditions. It does need to contain state conditions. The federal permit does need to meet state law. We do not believe that the legislature intended for state law to disappear when it instructed the agency to issue NPDES permits according to federal law. We simply looked at that as the question of issuance of those permits, what conditions pertain to issuance. So our proposal here, and we think it's supported by rule and by law, is to keep state conditions in the NPDES permit a one-stop shop for all your legal authorities. We think that's the most helpful, and we think that is the most legally supported position.
Thank you. Any further comments from the staff on this substantive matter? Let's hear from Mr. Berger now that we're on the subject of his letter and his comment. I'd appreciate that. Mr. Berger, welcome to the board. Thank you for your proofreading corrections of our board packet.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner, and members of the board. And I'd like to thank the board both for accepting the letter from my partner, Gary Cook, as well as the staff for recommending those to what we thought were typographical type or processing errors and correcting those. But as the letter indicates and as the staff has explained a little bit here, there is one other substantive change that we wanted to bring to the board's attention. I guess before I get to that, I should clarify, I am an attorney with the Gislason Law Firm, and I am here today on behalf of the Minnesota Pork Producers Association, who is one of the industry groups who participated in the rulemaking process and made some comments. But I just wanted to make that clear for everybody. The substance of issue that I want to talk about is the combination of the NPDES and SDS permits in the proposed rules, both as initially proposed, and I believe that there are some residual aspects of that that have carried forward and are still being proposed, and that represent important substantive legal changes that have not been appropriately vetted at this time. To address those issues, though, I think we need to go back and look at a few things from the current rules and where things stand. As the staff explained, there are two separate permits right now, the NPDES permit and the SDS permit. In the existing version of Rule 7020.0405, subpart 1, there's four letters that address the various permits that may be required. The first letter, A, addresses the MPDES permit and the circumstances under which that would be required. But when we get to the existing rule, in letter B of the existing rule deals with when an SDS permit is required. And the very first phrase of this existing rule states, unless required to apply for a permit under item A, which refers back to the NPDES permit. So the existing rule makes very clear that if an NPDES permit is applied for and obtained, an SDS permit is not required. It's only required if an NPDES permit is not required under subpart A. Now, the existing rule amendments, which are before the Citizens Board here today, propose to delete that part of the rule. That is a substantive change to the law that, in effect, would require producers who have feedlots to potentially require both the NPDES and the SDS permit. Now, the agency explained that they've been doing it that way for several years, and that's the way things have been done. Now, I would ask the board to consider how the agency would respond if I were sitting here today representing a farmer who came before the board and said, well, this may be a violation of the rule, but it's the way I've been doing it for 20 years. It's still a violation of the rule, and this agency would enforce that. And so the fact that the agency has been combining these permits for a number of years doesn't mean that it complies with the existing rules. I would also point the Citizens Board to Rule 7001.1010, which also says if an NPDES permit is obtained that satisfies the requirements to obtain both the NPDES and the State Disposal System permit. It doesn't say the terms of those permits are combined. It doesn't say it's one permit. It says if you obtain the NPDES permit, that is deemed as a matter of this rule to satisfy any requirement to obtain this other permit. And so both of those rules that I've been discussing in the current law make clear that it's one or the other. And if you obtain the higher level, the federal NPDES permit, you're not required to obtain a separate state disposal system permit. And so we believe that when the agency proposed in this rule to combine as a matter of rule the NPDES and SDS programs, I believe, and the staff can speak to that, that proposing to delete the first clause of that B in the 7020.0405 would be consistent with that proposal, because that rule would, in effect, now be requiring producers to obtain the combined proposed NPDES/SDS permit. That proposal was rejected by the administrative law judge in this case. And I would point the members of the board to the administrative law judge's findings. I believe it's paragraph 148 through 151 discusses the issues, and 151 is the finding where the administrative law judge said the two permits are not required, only one is. And so the proposal to delete the first clause in the 7020.0405 subpart 1B appears to be a residual part of that proposal to create a joint permit. And because that underlying proposal was rejected by the administrative law judge in this case, and because the agency has indicated that it's not pursuing a joint permit in this case, that language should be retained in the existing rule. I'd also note that there was a reference in the staff presentation to the SONAR, or the Statement of Need and Reasonableness, which explains the rationale of why the agency is pursuing an amendment. That SONAR does not provide any separate explanation or justification for why the language in subpart 1B would be removed, except that it's part of the combined MPDS-SDS permit change. And so we believe that, in effect, this proposal is imposing a requirement that either intentionally or unintentionally, that two permits would be required instead of one, which is inconsistent with current law. A related issue on that is the proposal to amend Rule 7020.0505, subpart 5. And that's a specific one that was addressed in Mr. Cook's letter. And that deals with what the terms of the MPDS permit are going to be going forward. And that proposal proposes to add that the MPDS permit, it was initially proposed to be the joint MPDS-SDS permit, but now it's being changed to MPDS permit, must contain the conditions required under federal law and the conditions required under state rules. If you go back and look at the SONAR explains that that change is necessary based on the combined MPDS-SDS permit. And so when we're going to have a combined permit, it makes sense that you're going to include both the federal and the state conditions. But that is still a change to existing state law. And what it in effect does, even without calling it a combined MPDS-SDS permit, it is in effect combining those two permits into a single permit. Again, there's been no analysis, no explanation of the need for this, the reason why. We believe that that's a very substantive change to state law that would have serious consequences for the agricultural industry that hasn't been analyzed. This issue came about. The discussion of the combined permits was discussed at the public hearing and was rejected by the ALJ. But these specific changes, which were kind of an ancillary part of those larger changes, seem to have slipped through the cracks of that process. But a review of the SONAR, a review of the materials, makes clear that those changes were being proposed because of the proposal to combine the two permits. And we would ask that the Citizens Board reject those two proposed changes when considering the proposed rules. With respect to the remainder of the proposed rules, there was a very thorough public process. Mr. Cook has submitted the letter. We have submitted comments, as have various industry groups in that, and we would rest on that that record with respect to the remainder of the rules, and I won't take your time this morning. But because of the way this issue has kind of developed and evolved during the process, we believed it very important that the board fully understand that issue and consider those issues in considering final adoption of the rules.
Thank you, Mr. Berger. If I could just clarify your specific request, then would be that we not modify permit the rule language in regard to the requiring of an NPDS and an SDS permit. And what I mean by that is the outcome of your request would be that an individual owner may need two separate documents from the agency.
No, Mr. Commissioner, I believe that under the current rule and under the language that we would be asking the board to retain, an SDS permit would not be required if an NPDES permit is required and obtained. So the receiving and applying for and receiving an NPDES permit under Rule 7001.1010 is deemed as a matter of rule and a matter of law to satisfy any other requirement for a state disposal system permit. So we would be saying that only one permit, and that would be the NPDES permit, would be required.
Understood. That's a, and you're speaking specifically to the rule provision. I'm going to ask Ms. Cohen to comment on this once we're done understanding the. So the statute, if there's statutory language, Ms. Cohen, I'd like to hear from you about what the statutory language provides relative to the specific rule provision that Mr. Berger has raised.
And if I could clear that the just. For the record and for the
yes.
board, the specific changes that we would be asking to the proposed rule would be to retain the existing language in 7020.0405, subpart 1B, that begins that sentence and states, unless required to apply for a permit under item A. And then we would be asking in 7020.0505, subpart 5, to eliminate last part or the last clause of the proposed amendment that addresses the incorporation of the state rules into the NPDES permit.
Thank you. Ms. Cohen, would you like to illuminate the board with your perspective on this?
Thank you, please. Mr. Commissioner. I would. I think we are not disagreeing about the outcome here. I think we are essentially in a dispute about how to get to the same outcome. The way the state staff interpret the existing rule, and the ALJ also agreed with this, is there is a existing state rule that says if you get the one permit, you don't need to get the other one. We agree. If you get an NPDES permit, you don't need to get a separate SDS permit. That's why we wanted to change the name, to make it clear to the regulated parties that you've gotten what you need under federal rule, under state rule. You're done. You got this NPDS/SDS permit. So we thought we were being helpful to the regulated community to make it clear that the NPDS permit covered any separate requirement under state law to get a state permit. We were trying to be helpful with making this change in the rule to name the permit NPDS/SDS. We were not trying to change any requirements in either the NPDS permit or the SDS permit. Now Mr. Berger has raised a separate issue. The separate issue is whether the NPDS permit can also contain conditions driven by state law. What are we talking about? We are talking about conditions protective of groundwater, for example. We are talking about conditions such as setbacks that you might only find in state law and not in federal law. There we turn to other existing state rules of this agency, and in particular, 7001.1080, which provides that a National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System permit issued by the agency must contain conditions necessary for the permittee to achieve compliance with all Minnesota or federal statutes or rules. So it's very clear under your existing rules that an NPDES permit must contain whatever conditions are necessary to meet state law as well as federal law. And this is true upon issuance as well. This agency must find that the permit it's issuing will create compliance with both federal law but also state law. So I don't think there's any controversy there. And whatever permit this agency issues also has to be in compliance with state law. So, a rose by any other name would smell as sweet. We wanted to call the NPDES permit issued in the feedlot program an NPDES/SDS permit because that is what it has always been called without controversy. It has always included state law conditions without controversy, and we are merely proposing to continue what has been done in the past. We are not making any changes here whatsoever. We are just placing into the feedlot rule what is in other existing state rules that are applicable to feedlot permits, which are issued under Chapter 7001.
Ms. Cohen, if I can just clarify for my own sake, and the law judge found that to be a reasonable approach.
Correct. This exact issue maybe didn't come up clearly in the comment period. The change of name issue did. The ALJ recommended just go back to the NPDS name because you have an existing rule that says that getting an NPDS permit covers state law obligations. You don't really need to change the name. We said, fine, if that'll get rid of the controversy, we'll go back to the old name. That's what we did. As far as whether state law conditions are included in permits, that was not challenged at any point during the comment period. The ALJ found that that rule was needed, reasonable, and legally supported.
Thank you, Ms. Cohen. And Mr. Berger, I'm going to just, for the sake of closing this discussion, I'm going to advise the board members that because the hearing record supports the agency's approach, I believe I'm going to give the board members my perspective, which is that the rule language that is developed is reasonable and that this issue that you've raised is beyond the scope of what we have debated in the rule process up to this point, that I would advise board members I'm going to treat it as a separate issue to be taken up separately with the staff. But I'm prepared to act on the rule language as drafted, and I do not see the need to address the issue that Mr. Berger has raised before the board today, just for your perspective. Mr. Riddle.
What about the two kind of technical corrections that
yes,
were raised?
We do want those corrections in our documents to be reflected, and we'll take action on those when we move forward. Thank you, Mr. Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner, and members of the board.
I also have a letter from Mr. Bob LaFave from the Minnesota Milk Producers Association. Mr. LaFave, I don't know if you want to speak before the board, but I do want to, again, distribute this letter and ask for your acceptance of it into the record, and we'll pass these out. And Mr. LaFave, thank you for this letter. In a number of circumstances, the Milk Producers Association have been very productive in terms of engaging with the agency and review and comment during the process of this rule development. And thank you for your efforts to kind of put a final comment before the board members. But board members, I'll just ask for a motion to accept this letter into our record. Mr. Jensen moves and Mr. Riddle seconds the motion to accept this into the record. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. It's adopted. And board members, just take a second to kind of peruse the letter, and if you have questions, we will take them. So if I can just a couple of points Mr. Lefebvre makes in his letter that I think we'll follow up on with the staff in implementing the permitting and regulatory procedures that we'll follow. One is relative to the permitting process that we will utilize to ensure sort of the consistency of our approach statewide across all of our permit types that will ultimately flow from these rule changes. There will be different forms of permits that will be written under this rule, and so just a note to our staff that that's always a goal that we have, but just to make it clear that we aim to be efficient and consistent in our implementation of our permitting procedures. Secondly, with regard to the liquid mineral storage areas design criteria, there'll be, again, work that we'll need to do to implement those with feedlot owners and operators and their design professionals that work in this field. We'll want to make sure that we conduct those efforts consistently and efficiently. Lastly, I'll take this point as a future issue as well. Mr. Lefebvre raises the question of the definition of identifying a pollution hazard in part of the rule. And again, that would be something that did not come up during this rulemaking process that would be in the scope of another, a future rulemaking effort. With that, board members, any other questions on the matter before us? Seeing none, I would like to move to the proposed staff resolution. And Ms. Cohen, if I could ask you to come to the table in case there are questions on the amendments that oral amendments we might need to make to the draft staff resolution. So the proposed suggested staff resolution is found on page 16 of 16 in the materials that came with this on the board item. And just to read it out loud, it says, be it resolved that the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency adopts the attached proposed amendments to Minnesota Chapters 7001, 7002, and 7020, governing permitting operation and maintenance of animal manure and processed wastewaters. Be it further resolved that the MPCA approves and adopts the attached findings and order adopting the rules that the commissioner or his designee is authorized to sign the findings of order on behalf of the MPCA and perform all acts necessary to make the rule have the force and effect of law, and that prior to publishing the rule as adopted in the State Register, the commissioner or his designee is authorized to make any form changes in the rules that the reviser of statutes requires the MPCA to make in order to obtain the reviser's certificate as required by Minnesota Statute Chapter 14. That's the suggested staff resolution. Ms. Cohen, I know we had two amendments to the findings of fact, and I'm just curious about whether or not we should adjust the resolution or we should just, how would you advise us to address that question?
Mr. Commissioner, members of the board, I'm going to advise you to do what works, whatever works best. My suggestion would be to change the second be it resolved clause of the suggested staff resolution to indicate that the MPCA approves and adopts the findings and order adopting rules with amendments to Part 7F and Part 7G. As discussed at the board meeting. So I don't know whether that's going to be good enough or whether we should actually state what those changes are. If you want, I could read them into the record and maybe that would make for the clearest resolution.
That would be helpful, Ms. Cohen. If you could read the amended Part 7F and 7G. These are in the statement of need and reasonableness, or is it in the findings
of
fact?
It's in the order.
In the order.
Yes, the findings of fact and order adopting rules. So this would be the resolution that the board would be adopting. And I will be correcting the second paragraph that starts, be it further resolved.
Yep.
Be it further resolved that the MPCA approves and adopts the attached findings and order adopting rule with the following amendments. To Part 7F, the language that appears under the heading 7020.0405 permit requirements, subpart 1, is deleted. And in Part 7G, in the language that appears under 7020.2003 water quality discharge standards, subpart 2, item B, strikeout should appear where it states NPDES/SDS. And the rest of the resolution clause remains the same.
Thank you, Ms. Cohen. Board members, those are the two specific changes that were identified by Mr. Cook and the letter from the pork producers. And we saw them in the staff presentation on a couple of the slides. So if you're unclear as to what they are, please ask questions now. Otherwise, I'd ask for a motion to move the suggested staff resolution as adjusted by Ms. Cohen's statement. Mr. Ibarra moves. Is there a second? Second by Mr. Riddle. Any further discussion? Any further discussion? Seeing none, I will call the roll since this is a decision item. Mr. Ibarra.
Aye.
Dr. Sampson.
Aye.
Mr. Gustafson is absent. Dr. Drager.
Aye.
Dr. Foley is absent. Ms. Hang is absent. Mr. Jensen?
Aye.
Mr. Riddle?
Aye.
And the chair votes aye. There are 6 votes in favor. The motion passes. Staff members, thank you for your presentation. Members of the public who appeared today, thank you for your time and your input. Board members, we will recess. We're back on the record at the Citizens Board meeting for the MPCA on Earth Day, April 22nd, 2014. And we are on the information item, board members, which is our budget overview, which I think came up in a previous board meeting where we talked about kind of doing a flyover of our budget. And so today we have Lyle Mueller, our Chief Financial Officer, going to help us with that. And Lyle, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Commissioner and board members. I do like the idea of referring to this as a flyover because the presentation was when I put it together at a fairly high and general level. As the commissioner suggested, the idea was to give you just this a sense, an overview. If there are particular items that you want to do a deeper dive, I can attempt to do that today or get back to you or come back in another presentation. So hopefully this is not going to be a stump the CFO kind of an approach. But...
Now you challenged. You put the challenge out there, Lyle. We'll see how long that holds.
Well, you do know I have call a friend. I have 3. All right.
But no friends.
So here's the series of slides that we're going to touch on today. And so let's get on with it. So one of the things that we wanted to present was just a bit of history as to the budget of the agency. And so what you have in front of you is a 10-year view, and so years fiscal 6 through 13 are actual expenditures, and 14 and 15 are budget expenditures, keeping in mind that, you know, so each bar is a individual fiscal year. The bienniums, however, are, you know, so grab the first two bars, that would be a biennium, 8 and 9, 10, 11, kind of all the way through. So a number of things that are notable is, one thing is the kind of the lessening dependence on the general fund as a funding source for the agency. And now one of the things that is a little bit off the map is OEA and the MPCA were brought together starting in fiscal 6. So that is the first year of the combined agency. You'll see that the general fund, which is the red, so it's the first color in the bar, did in fact increase for a number of years, and I'm kind of challenging your memory here. There was the passage of the Minnesota's Clean Water Legacy Act in 2006, so there was a step up in funding for the provisions relating to that act starting in 2007. Question? Let's go. Let's take questions all the way through.
Thanks.
The scale is in thousands of dollars.
Yes, so the top of the scale would be $200 million.
And Lyle, you also mentioned OEA, which some board members may not remember is the Office of Environmental Assistance, yes. Which was a separate entity prior to 2006. Mr. Riddle.
And these are sources of revenue, not expenditures?
No, these are expenditures, but
every expenditure is
every
a source
expenditure
of revenue.
From a particular fund, and we're going to spend more time going through that.
So today. It's both, essentially.
Yes. Okay. Going on to fiscal 8 and 9, that was a biennium where we had an even higher level of funding for the Clean Water Legacy Act, also from the general fund. And then starting, you know, between fiscal 9 and 10, a miracle happened, which is the passage of the legacy amendment, which established the four new legacy funds. So the Heritage Fund, the Clean Water Fund, Parks and Trails Fund, and the Arts and Culture Fund. Remember, that was the additional 3/8 of 1% added to our sales tax. So beginning in fiscal 10, so remember that passed in November of 2008, which was in the kind of the end of or middle of fiscal 9. So then the first fiscal year that we received money from the Clean Water Fund was starting in fiscal 10.
Mr. Riddle.
Yeah, on the legacy dollars, the concept was that they were to supplement and not supplant. I don't know if that applied to the budget of PCA as well. I know that that's the way it was pitched to local units of government. This is going to be extra money. But I see as they came in, the general fund went down. So it appears that they are supplanting rather than just supplementing.
Let's hear your answer to that one, Mr. Miller. We have had that question before.
Commissioner and board members, the money that was appropriated to the agency from the general fund was appropriated with the language it was a one-time appropriation. So the money that came to us in 07, which was, you know, just 1 year in that biennium, was also written at the end of 7 it ends. It does not continue. It's not part of your agency base. So the money that was appropriated to us in each of 8 and 9 also had that same provision that said this is a one-time appropriation. So at the beginning of every legislative biennial budget session, the agency needs to go in and request, you know, almost as if starting from scratch. So there was not an assumption that the money that was coming to us from the general fund was a part of our base or ongoing operating budget.
And that's sort of the technical answer is there was no guarantee it would continue, therefore was not supplanting those dollars. Why don't you go ahead, Lyle?
So just a couple other things to note. Some of the other, whether it's state or federal funds, have remained fairly constant over this 10-year period. For example, there has not been a huge step up in the environmental fund, which is the green bar. The other color of note is the federal funds, which is going to be the second from the top, which has stayed relatively constant over this 10-year period. But as our overall budget has grown over this period of time, percentage-wise, it has become a lower percentage of our overall budget. One other thing of note, because we're going to see this on another graphic, is that step down in fiscal 12, which is the, believe it or not, the impact of the shutdown. We're talking about 20 days that state agency workers were not on the job. However, in reality, there really was a much greater impact in terms of kind of a slowing down of the or an immediate stoppage of the work on July 1st, but then a kind of a ramping back up as employees came back to work on July 21st or whatever the exact day was. And not an immediate resumption of activities, whether it was in the field or the remediation work. For example, contractors had been sent home and moved their equipment off the job, and so it took a while to get everybody kind of back in action and back to work. So one of the other views that we actually kind of consider or have in front of us on an equal basis, or maybe it's even more important in some ways, is the money that comes that is appropriated to our agency comes to us in the budget bill in these five categories. So we have the three media categories: air, land, water. The next one is kind of a mouthful, which is ECAM, which stands for Environmental Assistance and Cross Media. So that's also the budget category that where for those issues that are multimedia in nature, those would be collected in that particular budget slice of the pie. We also get a major federal grant that ends up being in this part of our budget. So as we get authorization to spend, it's from that part of the budget, the ECM program. And then the fifth budget slice is the administrative support, which is basically kind of all our non-program or kind of agency support activities. So really the main purpose is just to give you an idea of the general size and relationship between the different programs, media programs in the agency. And water has been increasing, and for the last number of years has roughly been a third of our agency budget and budget activities. So one of the other questions that oftentimes comes up is you know, what's the relative comparison of our overall budget to what we might classify, and this is a very soft definition, but think of as our operating budget. And so now in this particular view, just this is the only slide where I've kind of fallen back to individual one-year set of budget numbers as opposed to biennial. So if we had in this particular year an overall budget that was approaching $190 million, we would roughly subtract about $30-35 million from that number and arrive at what we would think of as our our agency operating budget. The kinds of things that we've subtracted would be many of the grant and loan programs that we essentially pass through to mostly to local governments. So primarily counties or grants to soil and water conservation districts, those kinds of things. So operating wise, it would be the kinds of things that we may have staff attached to many of these different categories that you see displayed.
Lyle, just to clarify one more time, you said our annual operating budget close to $190 million. This total is $159 million. So that, you said, about $30 million go out the door for other
right.
purposes. They go to grants and other external actions, not that don't drive the agency's costs.
Commissioner, that would be correct. We would think of it as pass through dollars. So the dollars are appropriated to us, but oftentimes with language that says for grants to, and then fill in the blank. And an example would be the SCORE grants, which are right in rider language, $14 million, $14,250,000 divided between the 87 counties.
Mr. Riddle.
Yeah, could you just explain or give examples of the compensation category, which is quite significant there? What does that cover?
Commissioner and Board Member Riddle, that is the collectively, that's salary and fringe, as well as what we think of as severance or separation expense. That's right, combination.
About half our operating budget goes to our staff costs.
Commissioner and members, oftentimes you'll hear state agencies refer to their compensation costs as being most of their agency operations, 85%. For us, it is less than 50%. So, in a number of those categories, we do have significant expenditures for contracts. Contracts would be different than grant expenditures. Grants oftentimes are passed through to those local governments.
Mr. Jensen.
Under those contracts, even though we have compensation there, that would be agency staff, but there'd also be personnel employed by the contractors that would be wages and fringes as well. So this isn't all just materials and supplies. There's also additional revenue that goes back into the economy through the contractors' employees. Is that right?
Commissioner and Member Jensen, the contracts would primarily may fall in a number of categories. They would not fall in compensation. So compensation would strictly be agency employees. We do have a number of contracts that we would be paying out on under the minute category. There's a few members that. Or that particular part of our operations employs contract help. Program operations, they may have use a variety of contracts in order to carry out certain activities.
I think the question that Mr. Jensen had is, if we contract with a vendor to perform work, they are compensating employees, correct?
Commissioner, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So by virtue of describing something under another category, it doesn't mean that there aren't compensation costs occurring to others. That, I think, was your question, Mr. Jensen. Yeah.
Commissioner, the point I was trying to make is that in addition to the agency employee, there's a whole other element out there of people who depend on these contracts and so forth for their livelihood as well.
Commissioner, yes, absolutely. Yeah. That's right.
Okay.
So one of the other things that we thought might be interesting is just a historical view over our changes in FTE. So you clearly you'll see that this is not just a kind of constant upward trend. There are also some things to that we usually try to offer as explanation as well when people are seeing these numbers. I have yet to see two documents that agreed on the number of FTE associated with the agency. This is always a moving target. For example, getting ready for this presentation, I said to our budget unit supervisor, I thought I had remembered a conversation in the not-too-recent past that we were approaching the 1,000 FTE mark. And his answer was, well, we are, and so we're in fiscal 14, so the 921 would be an estimate of what we think we will actually pay out, number of hours that we will actually pay out in the fiscal year, divided by 2,088. So it doesn't take into account the fact that at any point in time there are a number of vacancies that are in the system or somewhere in process. So this becomes, it's always a difficult conversation to have around FTEs because it's a very different number than headcount or perhaps even actual number of positions that may be in play at a given point in time. So if you back up a year to 2013, that is, the fiscal year is done, kind of all of the dust has settled, and you're able to actually run a report as to how many discrete hours were paid by the agency for staff time, and divide that by 2088, which is kind of our working average number of hours in a fiscal year. So if we go back to 2006, again, remember this was after the combination with OEA. We did have a bit of a growth spurt for a couple of years as we received additional funding. So in 7, 8, and 9, we were adding staff to actually work the programs associated with the Clean Water Legacy Act. I think over a point in time, by the time we got into 2009, we were talking close to 50 FTE additional funding. Just associated with that funding and program. At the same time, we added, at that point in time, a distinct sector related to mining and ethanol, and there were as many as 12 or 14 FTEs associated with that activity. As you move ahead to 12, remember there's a number of years where as an agency, as the whole state of Minnesota was affected by the slowdown in the economy. There was a point in time when we were preparing for a fairly tight couple of budget years, and as an agency, we offered an early retirement incentive. That's what the ERI stands for on that particular little label box in fiscal 2012. Early retirement incentive, 21 individuals retired early or under the terms and conditions of those agreements and left the agency. So there was that particular level of step down in addition to the shutdown, which we also talked about. Again, 21 paid workdays or unpaid workdays times 900-some FTEs added up to that kind of a dip at that point in time. So the other thing of note is beginning in 2015, we are finally to the point in the minute, which is the IT across state government consolidation, where that group of employees will be actually coded and counted as a separate agency. So in 14, while we're still in transition, we are still counting, and it's 68, 70 FTE associated with our IT portion of our operations. They will now be counted across state government as a standalone agency.
If I recall correctly from Commissioner Parnell in the minute, Minnesota IT, the number will be somewhere around 2,000 FTEs statewide when the consolidation is complete. So all agencies have been doing exactly what we're doing here, is sort of predicting where that we're in a transition. The law passed in 2012, and it sort of fully takes effect in terms of budget, state budgeting operations in fiscal 15. So you're going to see this sort of accounting shift in terms of how the state treats its FTEs, with the idea that consolidation helps focus the efforts and services, and there are service level agreements going on. This IT consolidation, I understand from my peers, as I met with them a few weeks ago, all across the country, this is happening in states at varying times. But there is a significant number of states have moved to the back office consolidation conversation about IT. So that's in progress. And we have not, I would say, while we've seen some growing pains or some, you know, relationship challenges, it has not been painful to the agency at this point. Dr. Sams.
Yeah, oh, thank you. And maybe this is not a budget question, but I guess just from observing sometimes service organizations being separated from those that they serve can present unforeseen problems in the future. So just that it sounds from your discussion that talking with your peers and both outstate and within state that's something that's people are thinking about to make sure that you're not losing it.
Yeah.
You're not losing the connection between those who are supporting the agencies so that you can do your work well.
Yeah, the good side of this transition that we've been going through, and Michelle Beeman could talk about it some more too, but the service level agreement that we have is unique to each agency, although there are common elements across every agency. You know, certain IT infrastructure's got to work and have certain downtime requirements and all kinds of other metrics like that. But I do like that they've identified the CIO position as being jointly reportable. So the CIOs work in the agencies and in the central minute operation. And then the staffing resources can be in both places as well. So you do have this sort of blend of approach that's not just consolidation where, you know, there's sort of a divorce and everybody parts their ways. It's more of a blended family, I would call it, and it is so far working for us.
Okay, this graphic was in your packet, and just highlights the fact that what we receive through the legislative process, through the biennial budget process, is permission to spend out of each one of these individual funds. So collectively, again, now this is a two-year budget, so $383 million, which translates into about $190 per year. So what this graphic illustrates is, again, as I said before, the general fund has kind of fallen to that, you know, 3% of our overall total. So it's not a big factor in our overall funding. Clean Water Fund, we're going already into our sixth year or third biennium. Environmental Fund, which for us is our largest funding source, remediation. We're going to come back and talk about both of those, actually the three funds, Clean Water, Environment, and Remediation, in a little more detail. And then, as I said before, the federal funds, at this point, 12% of our overall budget, special revenue, and others, a variety of cats and dogs in those categories. One of the things that we had in preparation for this presentation is that we were just talking briefly about. So how does an ordinary citizen, how do they help pay for the work for the PCA? And so as I started to think about that and kind of go around the pie chart wheel, is like, while we all contribute to the money that comes into the general fund, and as we, you know, pay our income tax and do our purchasing and pay sales tax, perhaps fewer of us paying corporate tax or state property tax, but from the standpoint of the general fund, most of the general fund is spent on other parts of state government. So most of it goes to health and human services and aid to education, and it's less than 2% of the general fund comes back to any kind of environmental purpose at all. And so for us, as an agency, we're getting 3% of less than 2%. So you're down to essentially, you're down to pennies. When it comes to the Clean Water Fund, this is something where, you know, there actually may be a stronger connection, in that even though it's only 0.375% for all four legacy funds, the amount of money that comes into the Clean Water Fund per year is in the neighborhood of $95 million. So $95 million per year just for the Clean Water Fund. So that's after all of the – and remember, it was one – so one-third of the revenue generated for the four new legacy funds comes into the Clean Water Fund. The Environmental Fund, probably our biggest – this is probably where we have our biggest connection. So as you're paying your – whether it's a monthly or quarterly fee to your waste hauler, those fees in turn are paid in through the Department of Revenue in a tax called the Solid Waste Management Tax. And we're going to see in a next slide that that is a major revenue source into the Environmental Fund. For many of us, maybe once every however many years, you either buy a used vehicle, and one of the fees that's associated with a used vehicle is something called the Motor Vehicle Transfer Fee, and about half of that fee comes into the Environmental Fund. Commissioner, you're giving me the look like a very not a well-known fact.
I did not know that.
So.
The other half goes to help Dennis, part of, you know, one-millionth of 1% of whatever you get out of that fund, right, Dennis?
So the other for a certain slice of the population, if you're a business owner and you may fall in a particular category, perhaps you needed an operating permit to, you know, open a facility, and in that way you may again have come into or have a connection with our agency. One of the other places that we may pay, although it's hard to make the connection, in Xcel Energy is paying fees to our agency, operating fees that are in the millions of dollars. When they build their rate structure, certainly that cost is kind of incorporated into their rate structure. So perhaps fraction of a penny or however that works out is somehow woven into the monthly utility bill that you pay that way as well. Okay, so looking more, a little more closely at the Environmental Fund, you'll see, as I said, the Solid Waste Management Tax is a major revenue driver for this Environmental Fund. And while I suggested that because of, you know, we have a low dependence on the general fund, and so when the economy is not doing as well as it was a few years ago, that we may be somewhat buffered, we certainly were equally buffeted by changes in the Solid Waste Management Tax during the downturn. That for us made a big difference in terms of the health of the fund.
Less trash. When the economy turns down, there's less solid waste. When there's less solid waste, there's less solid waste tax.
this is also one of those taxes that we want to watch into the future as we work diligently to increase recycling. We also may, again, see a plateauing of the of the solid waste management tax. So something that we'll have to watch. Collectively, the permits that we issue, fees and permits that we issue, water, air, and land, 29 or a little bit less than 30%. Again, the motor vehicle transfer fee at 10%. The Metro Landfill Abatement Fee, this is a fee that's paid at either two or three active solid waste sites in the metro area, and the money is then kind of pushed back out to a consortium of metro counties. So I think we retain about less than 10% of that revenue stream. The next one is kind of interesting, and there was a question from one of the board members about penalties. Number one, at 2% of our of the revenue sources to this fund are, number one, not a major revenue driver. What we are collecting at this point, so if you divide that 3.8, you get to $1.9 million per year, which is a 5-year rolling average. So we have collected penalties over $2 million as we did a couple years ago. This year we're on track to collect closer to $1.1 million or $1.2 million. So there can be that kind of variation. In terms of what we spend as an agency on enforcement, we're up closer to $10 million. So there is not a hardwired connection between the penalties that come into the Environmental Fund and how we plan, budget, and fund our enforcement activity. So to kind of what I'm doing here is I'm kind of giving you a 2-year picture. So in this particular fund, if we start into the 2 years, we start into 14 and 15 with $20 million sitting in the fund balance. We add $184 million in new revenues, and then this is how we spend, or we have the authority to spend, because we do have to request the authority to spend from the Environmental Fund in all of these areas. So you'll see that we were granted permission to spend $143 million over this 2-year period. In addition to that, there are three other state agencies that were also granted permission to spend from the Environmental Fund to the tune of $1.3 million. And finally, the other significant use of resources was $46 million that was transferred to the remediation fund. And we're going to talk shortly about what goes on in the remediation fund. And then at the end of 15, we're projecting that there will be $13 million still on the bottom line in the fund. So questions about the fund?
Nope.
So think of this as all of those revenues that we talked about coming into the fund. This is kind of a mix and stir approach. They come into the fund, and they lose their distinct identity, and then can be granted authority to spend on our range of programs. So it's not that one-to-one relationship that you may have thought existed.
Sorry. Okay, go ahead.
Go ahead. Okay, did I go too far here?
No, I think you're right.
Okay, all right. So, remediation fund. Again, as I said, the very, very close relationship between the Environmental and Remediation Fund. You can see the 71 million that comes in from various sources, very few or a very small amount comes from its range of fees, penalties, and other receipts. We are extremely dependent on that transfer from the Environmental Fund. A second significant transfer in comes from the Petroleum Fund, and the uses of the money from the Petroleum Fund primarily is associated with the cleanup at, you know, or the contamination is caused by petroleum, oil, gas, and so there are some requirements that you know, the money from the, that comes in from the Petroleum Fund can't be used, for example, in closed landfill cleanup activity. So there is some segmenting of how the money is used, and you'll see on the next slide that, for example, if we do move money in from the Petroleum Fund, and as the dust settles on the fiscal year, we have money left over, we need to send it back to the Petroleum Fund, and that's that $0.9 million kind of at the bottom of the slide. The other activities that are being funded from the remediation fund include our suite of land programs, which is the closed landfill construction, closed landfill operations and maintenance, Superfund, and then the petroleum. And then we have Vic and Brownfields as well. There are five other agencies that have permission to spend from the remediation fund, the Department of Agriculture, Economic Development runs a brownfield grant program from the remediation fund. Department of Natural Resources spends on their natural resources damages account. And then there's a little bit of solid waste field citations that run out of the Department of Natural Resources, the Attorney General's Office, and the Department of Health. Okay. So then looking at the kind of focusing specifically on the Clean Water Fund, remember this, you know, as I said, this is one of the new legacy funds. We are, as the MPCA, is not the only player in that fund. There are, you know, these are all of the agencies that also get permission to spend from the Clean Water Fund. The MPCA is the as the second highest. However, we probably have the most ongoing operating programs that operate from the Clean Water Fund, as opposed to the other agencies do a little more of granting or pass-through dollars than we do as an agency. Again, so you just heard me say we are supporting ongoing operations from the Clean Water Fund. However, we are given permission to spend from the fund that continues to carry the designation these are one-time appropriations, which means that every legislative cycle, every biennial budget, every 2 years, we need to go in with a new request. And potentially, we could walk away with zero. Unlikely, but possible. At this point, we have close to 90, maybe even over 100 FTE that are linked to the funding that we receive from the Clean Water Fund. So if there were a significant change in our spending authority, we would be scrambling to make some significant changes. So questions on that? And again, just because it's new and this is kind of a high interest area, this gives you an idea of how over this period of time, now this is PCA only, how our level of appropriation, which started in 2007, has grown, and in the first 07 was the first year, the next biennium. The $30 million was from the general fund, and then, 8 and 9 was from the general fund, and then starting in 10, it's been from the Clean Water Fund. Questions on that? So one of the other things that I was going to do is I was just going to touch on the fact that and maybe I won't even do this, which was I was just going to bring up our website and show that on our agency website, our external site, there's a way to get to financial information, and I think we hope that this is perhaps maybe a little more intuitive, or we wanted it to be a little more intuitive than it is. You have to go to About the PCA, and then one of the choices at that point is what's called financial transparency. And it brings up a number of pages, some of the same information that I just went through on in this presentation. But it also then links to a lot more information on the clean water, the activities, their expenditures. And it's a site that we hope to keep adding more screens and more directions that you can move once you started that screen.
Dr. Sams.
Yeah. Thank sure. you. Before we go on, I have one question about this chart here. Just curious, I mean, the numbers seem to make sense. I'm just looking at the applied research and tool development. It's almost a change in an order of magnitude for the 14-15 biennium. Is there a different focus? I mean, I'm just curious why the other changes seem to make kind of flow from one another. That's a pretty significant jump. I'm wondering if there's a specific effort that money is being directed towards.
Do you know about that, Rebecca? Or Rebecca's behind you, Lyle, if you want help. Or if you have the answer.
He does have a phone.
Is this a phone a friend here?
Yeah, yeah. So Dr. Sampson's asking about the change from 0.8 million in applied research to 5.6. Yeah. I don't know. Oh, that's probably, yeah. I think I heard you say WDIP. I think that's right. And Joshua is nodding in the affirmative in the back as well.
The other
right.
thing that, Mr. Chair, members of the board, the other thing that I would mention is that we got an appropriation of $2 million for an interagency data portal development because we are collecting lots and lots of water quality information as a part of Clean Water Fund, and we want to make it available to people. So we're pulling all the data that we're scoping out the possibility of building an actual data portal that will connect. You come through one site and connect to each agency's water-related information.
$2 million a year, or is that $2 million total? Do you recall?
It was $2 million for the biennium.
Okay,
great.
So that would be one of the tools.
Yep.
Thanks. Go ahead, Lyle.
Okay, so we talked about this. Well, one of the other areas that I just wanted to briefly touch on, and you'll thank me later for not going into any more detail, is this question of how we know how we're doing, and certainly there are a number of things that we do internally in terms of we have an active what's known as the fiscal systems. Management team that kind of looks at reports and at least on a quarterly basis comes back to the senior managers and just does a check-in and kind of how we're doing in terms of spending our money. Every July at the beginning of the fiscal year, there's a kind of a turn of the crank that is done by the Department of Management and Budget, where you basically have to certify your budget for the year. And one of the things that they're looking for is to make sure that you have enough money put in the right place to fund your staff, for the rest of the year, and that you have that the all of the authority that you were given to spend for the year is actually set up in the budget plan and that there's substance behind it. So certainly we accomplished that. One of the other areas that has been new over the last 5 years is a focus on internal controls. And so there's a fairly extensive reporting tool that we use to describe and document our internal control framework, and that needs to be presented to MMB on an annual basis as well. So three of the other significant audits, and even though these seem like they're back in time, the Office of the Legislative Auditor does maintain a rolling schedule of when they check in with state agencies. And it used to be that they were at an agency like ours about every 4 years. Well, the last time they were here and wrote the audit was 2009, so it's 5 years. I think they're kind of stretching their time frames a little bit, but we expect to get the call any day now that they'll be back to run through another audit routine. The focus will be on our financial operations, but also they also look very closely at the internal controls and that structure. A little more than 2 years later, we had two separate audits where we were kind of front and center. The OLA did an audit of the legacy funds, but the focus was on the outdoor heritage, the clean water, the parks and trails, and the agencies that were included in the audit were the PCA, DNR, and Bowser. They did not go any further than that. And again, that was a fairly detailed look-see in terms of how agencies were doing, whether you're complying with the purpose of the funds. A lot of conversation about the administrative and how administrative costs for the agency were applied to the dedicated funds. Another audit that we were involved in as well was the accounts receivable and debt collection audit, which actually started at MMB. What they were looking at is accounts receivable across the whole state system. And since we were carrying significant accounts receivable in some of our program areas, specifically enforcement and Superfund, we were active participants in that audit as well. So in each of these, there is a series of recommendations that they make based on their findings, and they are very helpful. It's a good cross check to have somebody come in from outside and take a look at your operations.
Great.
So
thank you, Lyle. Any other questions, board members? Hope that gives you a good sort of snapshot overview of our budget. And one of the things that I'll just say in wrapping up, that many agencies have different budget structures than we have. Our budget structure is relatively minimal in terms of the number of funds that we draw from. And then we are, because of that, can do a little bit better job of being flexible and leveraging those funds against each other. We do not have budget oversight committees like the DNR does, for example, who are charged by the legislature to meet frequently and watch specific funds and how they are used. So we are, in that regard, we do our best, and I would say philosophically, we try to hold ourselves to a very high level of scrutiny, accountability, and transparency, as Lyle said, so that we can maintain that flexibility. If we lose that flexibility, we wind up with far greater number of reporting requirements and views of folks who think that priorities should be different. So that's just in characterizing our budget, I would put it that way. Mr. Riddle.
Well, just one quick question. I noticed a beginning balance of around $20 million, which seems to be about 10%. And I'm just wondering if you try to maintain a budget reserve of about 10%, is that accurate? Or how many months, you know, operating expense? How do you? And I don't want to go into great detail here.
Sure. Lyle, maybe you should. It varies by fund, but I'll let Lyle speak to that.
Commissioner and board members, there is some guidance that comes from MMB in terms of keeping a, you know, kind of a an amount on the bottom line, and that varies. And the other consideration is that if you are in fact carrying a sizable balance in a fund like the environmental fund, which, you know, so on an incoming level of $80 million, if you're carrying $8 million as a reserve, let's say, you could also say, well, that's $8 million that's not being put to work. So it becomes that balance of, well, you know, how much of a reserve do you want to carry to buffer against some of the ups and downs of your revenue stream versus having money that's basically just sitting in the fund?
We have, my experience is we've had up to 10%. We've had as little as 2%, depending upon the fund, depending upon the year and the circumstances in which we find ourselves. So that it really does sort of, Lyle does pay close attention to the revenue forecasts that come out monthly. You know, there are sort of updates on the cash flow of the state, and our agency watches that carefully, as do all. But the job of our CFO is really to help us think forward, not about the here and now. And most of our program staff are about delivering the work here and now. But Lyle and his team do a great job of helping us think longer range about how making a choice here is going to impact us down the road. And the agency has really strong fiscal controls, and so we're very well served by Lyle and his team. Thank you.
Thank you.
Board members, any other issues? If not, move to adjourn. Moved by Mr. Barr and seconded by everybody. We are adjourned.